Good morning and welcome to Backchat. I'm Jim Gould.
And I'm Hugh Chiverton. It's all policy address this morning. Chief Executive Carrie Lam has delivered her second blueprint for the SAR with a focus on housing and land supply. At the heart of it is the Lantau Tomorrow Vision, involving a major reclamation of about 1,700 hectares for the East Lantau metropolis, which could provide homes for up to 1.1 million people. That's much bigger than an earlier plan involving 1,000 hectares. She also said the proportion of public housing and new developments would be raised to 70%.
Among other measures, Mrs. Lam also promised to extend maternity leave to 14 weeks from the current 10 to promote the role of women in the workforce, take further steps to encourage innovation and technology research, and adjust charges at the Cross Harbour tunnels to ease traffic congestions. On national security, she said her administration would continue to work towards creating a favourable environment for introducing legislation under Article 23 of the Basic Law, but stressed that in the meantime it would not tolerate any acts which advocated Hong Kong independence. So what do you make of the policy address? Let us know your thoughts on any part of it. Email us at backchat@rthk.hk. That's backchat@rthk.hk. Or leave a message on our Facebook page Backchat on RTHK Radio 3, or give us a call on 233 88 266. We have in our Admiralty studio this morning Stephen Wong, who's adjunct, head of public policy at the R Hong Kong Foundation. That's the research group set up by former Chief Executive C.H. Tung. David Webb, shareholder activist and founder of website.com. And Vicky Davis, Vice Chairman of the Business and Professionals Federation of Hong Kong. Good morning to you all.
Morning.
Perhaps if we could start with you, Vicky Davis, what's your overall view then of the policy address?
I think she has addressed a lot of the issues that we are concerned with, primarily housing, healthcare, and so especially in housing, she's taken some bold decisions, which we're happy to see.
You mentioned healthcare. She mentioned that kind of in earlier on in the actual speech given to LegCo, but I didn't notice anything later on. What were the healthcare initiatives that you think were interesting or outstanding?
Well, we at BPF believe that rather than being very dependent on on just hospital care, we believe in more primary healthcare, so that we are not overloading our hospitals, which are very costly. A bed in the hospital is very costly. If we can do more primary health care and handle prevention.
So what did she do for primary health care?
She's starting to do a district health care centres that that focus more on primary health care. It is only a small step, but we hope to see more funding directed to prevention and looking after our elderly and our sick, rather than just pushing everybody to the hospital bed, which is very, very costly.
That's quite a small, as you say, that's a small scale thing. I'm just curious, because you've highlighted it, she highlighted it, she said it was one of three big things she was doing, but that's the only example I can find of primary healthcare is some local health care centres.
There's one good thing, if I could jump in there, that they're doing.
Try and stop me. Go on, yeah, go on. David Webb.
It's not often I can say that they're doing good things, but one good thing they're doing is they're going to vaccinate all young girls against HPV, the human papilloma virus, which causes something like 70% of all cervical cancer cases. It's quite expensive vaccine. I think it's going to cost, if you do the math roughly, assuming there's about 35,000 girls per year of age at around the 12-year-old mark, and it costs about 4,000 Hong Kong dollars for a course of three vaccines. So we'll be spending about 140 million per year on that. She doesn't spell that out in the address. But it will prevent probably about 70% of 150 deaths per year. So you'll save 100 lives per year doing that. So that's the rough cost of about 1.4 million. And of course, there are people who also get cancer and survive it. So and they have a horrible time too. And the victims tend to be quite young. So you're potentially saving 40 years of quality life. And if you divide that number out, then it's about 35,000 years per quality-adjusted life year, as they say. Yeah, so it's quite
again,
a good...
Vicky Davis, again, I mean, you've said this is... You mentioned two things, and one was healthcare. You've drawn attention to this. That's a health centre that's being set up in Kwai Ching District?
Yes.
That was proposed in the policy address last year?
What she's trying to establish are district healthcare centres. So when I say it's a first step, it's one center. but if this is made territory-wide, then it is extensive. That means that you have a great support system in healthcare in every district and not have to rush to the hospitals in the emergency rooms to deal with every minor flu or whatever. You know,
you might say it's a good principle, yes, but this is a tiny drop in the ocean.
This is a start. No. This is a start of a policy, and the policy is an important one. That is not to be so dependent on just hospitalization of people, but to do prevention. And there is also more funding for the Chinese medicine. I mean, when Tong Chi Hwa first came, and propose Chinese medicine and its importance within our healthcare system and as an industry, people poo-pooed it. But in actual fact, you see now qualified people, Chinese medicine practitioners, and Chinese medicine believes more on prevention and taking the care. So we shouldn't just be concentrating on...
I think that's a political sop, frankly. The Chinese medicine practitioners have 30 votes in the election committee. They practice unproven medicine. Whether you call it Chinese or traditional, it's mostly unproven. If it becomes proven, it becomes medicine. And then, of course, it should be available. But to somewhat deflect and distract people with saying, well, we'll provide you with Chinese medicine rather than Western medicine, runs the risk of more illnesses because we're not treating them properly.
Okay, Davis, I mean, when it comes to dollars and cents, the biggest thing by far is the issue of land supply and housing and so on. Do you think that these policies that are outlined, some of which are very bold, do you think they rekindle hope? Do you think that people look at them and read them and think, Hong Kong has a great future?
I think, I was very encouraged after I heard her policy address. I think she's decisive and she makes bold decisions which a lot of people have been wavering about. And we've been a talk shop for too many years, so we've got to get down to doing things.
I think she's going to do that. Yeah. Like, what would be an example of that?
An example of?
Of decisiveness.
Well, the fact that she has come up with a multi-pronged approach towards our land supply situation. She has come up with not just reclamation, although that has been a major focus of a lot of the feedback, but she has also proposed brownfields, the use of private agricultural land held by developers. So she is adopting what the task force has identified as most people wanting a multi-pronged approach towards our land situation.
Okay, Stephen Wong of the Our Hong Kong Foundation. Good morning to you.
Morning.
So the policy address is entitled Striving Ahead, Rekindling Hope. As one of my colleagues said to me yesterday, where did the hope go? Why does it need to be rekindled?
I can't answer to that question. I think that's a question for Carrie. But obviously, I think a lot of people share these thoughts that if you looked at, for example, we mentioned land before, that obviously in the past 20 years, the amount of newly created developable land has been stagnant. You know, because of that, you know, a lot of opportunities or growth or improvement in our society seems to be held back. So therefore, I think in order to make progress, not economically necessarily, but also socially and other areas in society, obviously, you know, I think that you know, one of the investment is into the land supply. I obviously can't speak for anyone about the logic of the policy address, but I think land, as Vicky said, I think is one key area to, you know, make progress socially and economically for Hong Kong as a society.
Now, your think tank, of course, has been keen on pushing this idea of the East Lantau Metropolis. The plan that Carrie Lam came up with yesterday is considerably larger than what was suggested earlier, not as big as you were suggesting, but what do you think of it?
Well, as we said, I mean, I think her logic of, you know, the three principles that she outlined in paragraph 62 is that, you know, she thought that the land supply is pressing. We should be prepared for rainy days, and a multi-pronged approach should be adopted. I thought those are good, you know, three good observations when we looked around of where we are. So in terms of reclamation, you know, the way I look at this is that, you know, since the 70s, when I was, you know, a little child, when I grew up, on average, we do about sort of three new town per decade. So, you know, in that 30 years, 70s, 80s, 90s, we have done nine new towns, and starting from Sha Tin. And so the way we do new towns at that time was through mainly reclamation, Sha Tin, Tuen Mun, Chang Kwan Lo, etc. And if you look, that's sort of the creating new town, and therefore we have new land, and therefore we have schools, residential areas, businesses, and stuff like that. So unfortunately, we haven't been doing any new town in the past 10 years or 20 years. The last new town is Dong Chong, which is completed, you know, more than 10 years ago. And what I would argue is that we would like to have, you know, maybe one new town in the size of Sha Tin for every 10 years in the next 30 years. So the difference between new town and other options is that new town like Sha Tin tends to have a bit more flat land where you can do, you know, a bit more proper planning and other initiatives like smart city or green city. I thought that if we can have an effort to actually build a new town in the size of Sha Tin, you know, for every decade, that will hopefully, you know, resolve some of the problem that we are seeing in the society.
How much will the East Lantau Metropolis cost?
You know, I think obviously it will be the way I see it is that the if we do nothing, you know, if we do 0 hectare.
No. How much will it cost?
I think it will be, as we estimated, if we just do the reclamation and, you know, in itself, you know, just counting the materials as well as the seawall that you have to build and design the whole process, that will be about 1,300 Hong Kong dollars per square feet.
So how much is that for the government proposed?
Well, the reason why I said that is you can do the multiplication. The reason
could you
I
do
tend
it?
To
how much is that?
The reason why I tend to focus on the unit cost is that I thought it would be a better comparison, right? Because I try to compare apple to apple. What I'm saying is that if you do a, for example, 200 hectares.
Of course, if you're going to compare apples to apples, you've got to look at infrastructure. You've got to look at.
Of course,
what? You have to double that cost to add for the infrastructure? Is that right?
Yeah. That's why I'm trying to explain to you, right? If we do,
for example. Then you shouldn't be looking at the flat, or you shouldn't be looking at the unit cost, because there's a flat cost of building an MTR there.
And can I finish?
Building all the roads. I just want to know how much it costs. How much
can I finish?
You
asked the question, right?
I mean, you've got Andy Lau and everyone on board. You've spent an enormous amount of money promoting this. We just want to know how much you think it's going to cost. How much
is it? While you've been asking, I've worked it out.
1,700, yeah.
It looked like about 240 billion Hong Kong for the land. If it's 1,300 per square foot of land, I assume you mean land rather than floor area. So
land area.
So that's about
I was trying to finish this logic. logic. If you're trying to compare apple to apple, if you do, for example, an alternative, right? If you build an alternative new town, let's say in New Territories North, you would obviously need a new infrastructure, road and railway as well. My underlying thesis is that in New Territories, generally...
I'm just asking, Mr. Wong, how much this is going to cost, how much you think this is going to cost.
Well, I said that, right? If you, for example... what the government now is saying is a phased approach where they would do it by phase, right? If you look at, for example, a first phase, let's say it's a smaller size, right, then obviously it's cheaper by unit cost. So therefore it's important to compare unit cost, for example, versus other methods of creating new towns. Other methods of creating new towns, for example, if you actually go out and build a new town in, for example, Hongshui-kyu.
Why won't you say? What? Why won't you say? Why is this such a secret?
Is my number wrong? It's $240 billion.
If you just compare, you just
for the land.
Can I just jump in here? I think what Stephen is saying is basically that if you take the production of land itself, when you take away infrastructure, which you would have to do anyway, and in fact, the infrastructure in itself brings a huge benefit. I mean, it's another corridor for us to get to the airport. Remember when we had a typhoon and the airport bridge had to be closed? So if you lump everything together and say this is the cost of reclamation, then it's not quite accurate because you're putting in infrastructure costs.
I'm just asking how much it's going to cost.
Yes, he's given you a
no, he hasn't.
Well,
he hasn't.
Yes, no, on land.
Yeah, I think, frankly, at the end of the day, if you are talking about a government proposal, they will obviously have to do the economic benefit analysis and the whole costing and stuff like that in the future. What I'm trying to say is that I try to focus on the unit cost because I think what are the alternatives is my question. If you do a smaller size, it will be cheaper. Do a bigger size, it will be more expensive. If you do it, for example, in new territories by acquisition of farmland and brownfield sites, that will be $1,500 per square feet. So what I'm saying is that, and plus if you were to do a 2,000 hectares.
I think there are costs to resume land if you're going to buy private land to build a new town. But there are other options that the government needs to be considering before they start filling in the sea. That's always the easy option because they own the seabed. The harder option is dealing with existing land in the territory. For example, there is a second airfield in Hong Kong, as people don't know about, up at Sek Kong. It's a flat piece of land that the PLA occupies, and there are some private pilots that use it at weekends. It was originally there for the RAF to defend Hong Kong against invasion from China. Now, invasion from China isn't really a risk anymore, and is really not necessary for the PLA to have its airbase here in Hong Kong rather than across the border and within 5 minutes flying time to defend Hong Kong. If we were to develop that, and it's a couple of hundred hectares, and remove the height limits on all the buildings around it, then you've immediately got a new town that Stephen's talking about. There's also a potential new town to be built on the big reclamation that's already there opposite Disneyland. That could probably house 50 to 100,000 people. It's about 150 hectares of vacant land at the moment. There's some talk about whether Fanling really needs three golf courses and 130 hectares of land for a private golf club up there, and whether that should come back without any resumption cost, of course, because it's only on a short recreational lease. And then you could build a new town there. So there are other places where you could do it.
What I don't understand, all three of you, is why we can't talk about the cost of this one.
I've told you
without trying to speculate about the cost of something else. The government has talked about a reclamation amounting to 1,000 a set size, population
hectares.
Of 1.1 million people, and so on. How much would that cost to build?
And I've said that the land cost would be about $240 billion based on Stephen's figure of $1,300 per square foot. Well, then on top of that, wherever you build housing, you're going to have a cost of building it. And wherever you build railways to connect to housing, there will be a cost to that too. I think it might be a bit higher if you have to go through the sea. So maybe reclamation should be, if we're doing it, should be against the land in 2 months.
Half a trillion. I beg your pardon.
Yeah, well, you can gross up all the costs.
But don't forget, there's a value. Is that accurate?
In a gross basis, yes, but then the benefits from that are more housing, offices, shops that you would have built elsewhere. So you can gross up the total cost, but then you've got to look at the whether or not that delivers the value it would have delivered in other places. So I don't rule out the need for more reclamation and doing it nearer Hong Kong Island than, say, Tuen Mun up at the power station.
Stephen Wong, is that right? Is it going to be about $500 billion?
I think that's the number that government have said, right? So what I'm trying to... I actually agree with David that the general thesis is that in Hong Kong, if you look at, for example, West Railway, East Railway, all the highways in the northern part of territories...
Because that's half our reserves. That's half the money we have.
Yeah, but it wouldn't all be paid for out of public purse. Once you start auctioning land, you get money coming back in. Developers then start building on it at their own cost and selling to end users. Mm. I do think we need to talk about some of the other issues in the address, such as this split between public and private housing.
Okay,
they go on. It's artificial to do that.
Okay, if I can add one more point. So according to your logic here, that you know, for countries or cities that have budget deficit, i.e., with no reserve or running budget deficit, they should not build any infrastructure. According to your logic, in fact, building infrastructure generally is not necessarily compared to your existing reserve, because actually the government asset is more than just existing fiscal reserves. So therefore, the comparison of whether the decision-making of whether you actually have building any infrastructure, roads, railways, versus of any sort of reserve that you have is a wrong comparison. Actually, because in that logic, you're saying that any countries or cities, like the U.S., for example, they're running huge deficit. They should not build anything. I mean, that's a wrong logic.
Okay, but you don't want them to just dig a hole and fill it in. You have to
help GDP.
I think that's David's point. I think you know you have to consider
unless you are the person who employs people who dig holes and fill them in.
So there is that.
And you're a developer. That's why I say you're a governor of the Our Hong Kong Foundation, and you stand to gain enormously from that work.
That's conspiracy theory. What I'm saying is that
it's not. I mean, Generally,
I think investment into any infrastructure, roads, railways, you have to consider the economic, you just have to do the economic and social impact assessment. And what are the jobs created as a result of that?
And you can't do that without somebody admitting to how much it's going to cost.
Well, no, I'm trying to do a unit-to-unit comparison to you as to what are the best options. Right? The best option is to, you know, first decide how much land do you need to actually create a new town. And second is where do you create a new town that is the most cost effective? And if you actually do it in the new territories, I think David pointed out other options, that's fine. But what I'm saying, if you compare to a you know traditional, for example, Hong Shui Kiu, the way they do it, that will not be cheaper than any other sort of reclamation option, is what I'm trying to say.
In a way, that the reclamation, at least the East Lantau one, I think is a bit of a negotiating tool against being able to resume land and drive down prices. If people think there's going to be a huge amount of land coming on stream, if the developers think that the government's going to produce its own land, they'll be more likely to negotiate and get deals done in the new territories with their farmland. So that helps in a way, but it shouldn't be the easy way out and avoid dealing with the problems in the new territories.
We'd better bring in Fernando Cheung at this point. We have a Labour Party legislator, Fernando Cheung, on the phone. Thanks for being patient. I know you can only be with us until 9 a.m. What do you think of what's been said so far?
I was listening in, and while you guys are talking about this grand and huge vision of Carrie Lam,
the Lantau Tomorrow vision.
I'm looking at from a someone who is poor. I'm looking at this whole grandiose thing from people who are sick, disabled, the old and the weak, and I'm wondering how this can fit in. How can these people fit into this rosy picture? While we have tens of thousands of people crowded in subdivided units, people who are sick, needing urgent medical care, you know, medicines costs are out of reach for them. There's lack of long-term care, lack of community care. So elderly are being sent to private but very low-quality homes. You know, even if Carrie Lam is talking about the 7-3 ratio in new lands in terms of the building ratio between public and private housing, in the next 5 years, we're still not being able to catch up with the plan that we unveiled in 2014. That was a promise of providing 28,000 public housing. We're already short by 80,000 as of 2023, and by 2026 we will be short, even with the 7-3 ratio, by about 60,000 flats. So, you know, it's not providing any solution. We're talking about huge amount of money. There's a lot of risks there, and it could be an ecological disaster. And yet we don't pay much attention to the population that I just spoke of. People are still waiting for quality care homes. More people are dying while waiting. We had more than 6,000 people die while waiting last year. Just, we're talking about frail elderly. And for disabled people, like my daughter, I just put her on queue to wait for a care home, which I would never do. But you know, the wait time for that is 17 years.
17 years. So
17 years.
I'm sorry, we'll have to pause it there. Thank you very much, Fernando Cheung. But we've got a break for the news summary. A very quick look at the weather. Cloudy with a few rain patches. The outlook slightly cooler in the morning and at night tomorrow. Sunny intervals over the weekend. It's currently 23 degrees, humidity 75%. Welcome back to Back Chat with Hugh Chiverton and me, Jim Gould. And this morning, we're talking about the policy address. Email us with your thoughts, backchat@rthk.hk. That's backchat@rthk.hk. Or leave a message on our Facebook page, Backchat on RTHK Radio 3. Or you can call us on 233-88-266. And we have a few messages before we return to our discussion with our studio guests this morning. Bowen writes, while the Chief Executive put much weight in her policy address yesterday, justifying the need to spend hundreds of billions of dollars on building the East Lantau metropolis over the next two decades, she has pointedly failed to address a problem much graver and of much more immediate concern to citizens of our city, meaning concrete plans or measures to strengthen Hong Kong's defence capabilities against the calamitous consequences of super typhoons, storm surges and sea level rises. We're not talking about something which may only possibly happen sometime in future. Take the most conspicuous example of Hang Fa Chun. In the wake of Typhoon Hato in 2017, the Eastern District Council submitted documents to the government in January 2018 requesting that follow-up work be done for the infrastructure defence capabilities of the housing estate against storm surges and typhoons, only to have its requests completely ignored by the government. Subsequently, this year's super typhoon Mangkhut caused much more extensive damage to Hang Fa Chun than those caused by Hato, as we all know. District Councillor Stanley Ho Nai Kam, who represents Hang Fa Chun, then drafted a letter to Carrie Lam, which was signed by many residents and forwarded to the CE's office. Various proposals were made in the letter, including extending and increasing the height of the nearby Wan Chai cargo handling basin's breakwater to cover the seaward fringes of the entire Hang Fa Chun. This would appear to be an eminently sensible action, given that there are already very many breakwaters built on both sides of the Victoria Harbour for at least half a dozen typhoon shelters. Mr Ho has since reported that he was only told by the CE's office that the letter had been passed on to the Development Bureau without the slightest indication whatsoever of the stance or attitude of the government on the matter. There were huge uproar in the meeting attended by hundreds of owners held by the Housing Estates Owners Committee on the 6th of October on the aftermath of Super Typhoon Mangkhut, which is totally understandable given that meteorological experts have warned of the certainty of similar visitations by super typhoons in future. One has to imagine what would have happened to Hang Fa Chun if Mangkhut had not blown into Luzon in the Philippines before going further in our direction. The incumbent chief of the observatory said in a radio interview that storm surges in Hong Kong would have reached 7 metres above chart datum. If that is not a call to immediate action by the government of the most urgent nature, I don't know what is. That's from Bowen.
A couple more comments. Michael says, Carrie Lam was responsible for a population white paper under Tung Chee Hwa, yet she refuses to state what is Hong Kong's optimal population level. The population may peak under normal current growth in 10 to 15 years, but now with the Lantau white elephant, which we built almost entirely by mainlanders, the population number will grow even further. Tensions will increase, the MTR will collapse, and demands on hospitals will continue to increase, and the quality of life will continue to decrease. I wish Carrie would stop talking about the red herrings of Hong Kong independence and a non-existent security problem and concentrate on our environmental and economic well-being. S says, with these huge housing developments, Hong Kong will need to manage a lot of waste. We're also running low on landfills. How are they going to cope? Not a thought, not a word on it. And according to a British study, there will be 70% more rubbish generated by 2050. Joe Average says, if you go through all the old buildings in Hong Kong, we do not have enough contractors for compulsory renovation. The same for compulsory fire systems. We don't have enough registered contractors. Just to change fire doors alone is going to take over 15 years at the present rate. So therefore, to have a new metropolis, you will have not enough contractors to build. Therefore, you'll be importing more workers. Hong Kong graduates are not going to shovel sand. Where are you going to house all these workers? Construction salaries will go up, and this put the price of all buildings and rent higher. Also, management fees will go up, and of course, we'll need more offices to house more consultants. Where are you going to put all these people? We will be well over 8 million. That comes from Joe Average.
Well, we have with us this morning Stephen Wong, who's head of public policy at the Our Hong Kong Foundation, David Webb, a shareholder activist and founder of website.com, Vicky Davis, who's vice chairman of the Business and Professionals Federation of Hong Kong, and also joining us on the line this morning, Alan Zeman, the chairman of the Lan Kwai Fong Group. Good morning, Alan Zeman.
Good morning.
So what do you think of this year's policy address?
Well, I was actually very, very encouraged. I think Carrie actually took the bull by the horns and was quite bold. Hong Kong, as we can see, just the complaints you've read out, many, many people are unhappy. Many people have been unhappy. Housing has been the number one problem in Hong Kong for a long time, and I don't think any of the previous chief executives has really addressed it. Now, I know this is not an immediate solution that she's come up with to house 270,000 or 400,000 people that have been waiting for a long time to get into public housing. I think the land reclamation is for the future. It's for our children. It's for our grandchildren. It's for the future of Hong Kong. Also, the Greater Bay Area is a fact. It's going to happen. We're working on a paper at the moment for the chief executive together with a group of 10 other people on the potential of how Hong Kong and Macau can fit into the different systems within the Greater Bay Area. Talk about 67 million people in 1.5 hour radius. It'll totally change Hong Kong. I mean, last 2 weeks ago, I was on the high-speed rail to Shenzhen and Guangzhou with the chief executive, and it took me 15 minutes to get from Hong Kong to Shenzhen, 42 minutes from Hong Kong to Guangzhou. And I said to the press coming off the train, they asked me, I said, it's going to change Hong Kong people's lives. You can basically meet your friend in Guangzhou for lunch or dinner and come right back again. It's no different than going from Hong Kong Island to Kowloon. So everything's going to change, and I think Hong Kong people have to really look into the future and look at what is good for Hong Kong. In the past, every chief executive we've had in the past was safe, basically. You know, all we did was increase the reserves, increase them. We're sitting with $1.1 trillion in reserves at the moment, which there's nothing wrong with it. But people are hurting. People are living in subdivided flats. You've heard Fernando Chung speaking, you've heard people are really, really hurting.
But what Fernando Chung was saying, he doesn't want mega projects. He wants the money spent on you know, services, social services, so that his daughter can get a home within 17 years. The money is being spent in the wrong way, and we're talking about massive amounts of money.
Yeah, but I think that in general, 20 years from now, 15 years from now, people will thank Carrie. I sit on the Airport Authority. I'm the chairman of the Business Development of the Airport Authority. We had a lot of problems with getting a third runway because we're maxed out at the moment, and people were saying, no, don't build it. There were 12 or 13 judicial reviews against reclamation and building it. But if we wouldn't, we would die. With the connections now to the mainland, we are part of the mainland. It's time we be realized.
Sorry, what's that got to do with the East Lantau Metropolis?
Well, I think that the East Lantau Metropolis with the bridge to Macau and
I'm not talking about the bridge to Macau. I'm talking about the East Lantau Metropolis, which has been sold so aggressively by the Our Hong Kong. You're on the board of the Our Hong Kong Foundation. What a surprise!
And I agree with it because I agree that.
And of course, the Business and Professionals Federation. Many of your people on your board are also on the board of the Our Hong Kong Foundation. Is that right?
Not that I'm aware of.
Well, no, people on your board are members of the are on the board of the Our Hong Kong Foundation. People like Vincent Lowe. That's right, isn't it?
Basically, I think, you know, by trying to build a conspiracy theory, you're doing a red herring and disservice to Hong Kong. First of all, Harry is coming forward with a multi-pronged approach. Brownfields are the ones that have been identified as one of the biggest support you get in the population. She is tackling that. And if you were to take all options off the table, no reclamation, no agricultural land or a collusion with developers, you're left with brownfield. How much do you have there? And no country parks when majority of our land is sacrosanct now because of the feeling on country parks. So where do we move? No reclamation. Only brownfields.
Okay, I think some people might be kind of slightly depressed by the way that this is being, apart from anything else, steamrolled through. I mean, Alan Zeman.
I think it's time that the media.
They haven't even finished this.
Of Hong Kong. If we would have taken that attitude under the previous administrations, Hong Kong would never be Hong Kong. And so it's really important that we, as we said, we can't take country parks. Only 25% of Hong Kong is buildable. 7% has been for residential. And so you can't change that. You don't want to go into the new territories. There's a whole other problem. You don't want to touch country parks. The land has to come from somewhere. And I think this is a very bold initiative. And I think that through reclamation, without reclamation, we wouldn't have had Sha Tin, we wouldn't have had Tuen Mun, you wouldn't have had other areas. And so I really think it's time that Hong Kong people and the media and everyone else stops being a naysayer on everything.
It's time that you're telling Hong Kong people what to do. I mean,
I'm not telling Hong Kong people. I've done enough. I tell you what I think, and it really upsets me because I think Carrie has come through with an incredible, one of the best policy addresses that I have seen. In 48 years I've been here, and in essence, I'm saying everybody's entitled to their opinion, and that's the freedom of Hong Kong, the freedom of speech, the freedom of thought, and that's fine. But I'm just saying that I really feel I get upset because rather than praising her and thinking that she's done a great job in the policy address that she has put forth, really to help Hong Kong people, to help Hong Kong, we have so many different problems. And so this is a step forward, and basically at the end of the day, we have money, we have huge money in reserves. I'm not saying to use all the money in reserves, but this will be over 14 or 15 years, and land sales will happen. 70% will be for housing for HOS, which under Donald Zhang and John Zhang for 7 years, they abolished a home ownership scheme, which when we should have been increasing home ownership scheme, we wouldn't have been in this problem right now. And so that's all I'm saying. I don't mean to tell Hong Kong people what to do. I'm just expressing what I feel is the right way to go. I think it's right, and that's my own opinion. And
yes,
everybody else is entitled there.
I agree with that, and I think that if we were to take all options off the table, don't do reclamation, don't do country parks, don't collaborate with developers that have agricultural
Sorry,
land.
Is somebody suggesting that?
But if you basically say no reclamation, a lot of the people don't want to touch the country parks. You don't want to also to get the developers to develop their agricultural land because it's collusion. Everything is collusion. So what are you left with? You're left with only brownfields. And Kerry has been working on a project since 2008 in the Northern District with brownfields and trying to get new towns there. It's been over 10 years, and they haven't even gone down, you know, we don't see anything yet. So, you know, you talk reclamation takes a long time. Well, brownfields also take a long time. So what we are saying is we have to be good. We have to make decisions that are good for Hong Kong. Nobody is saying that it's only reclamation. Also, we must be very clear that reclamation is not the whole 1,700 hectares in one go. It is going to be done in phases, and I'm sure the government will evaluate along the way to see how much is not oversupplying it.
Once the housing market crashes, there'll be a lot less talk about bulldozing ahead with the reclamation, I think. So it's kind of not necessarily all going to happen. But I think there needs to be a rethink on the public versus private dichotomy of the housing market. There is just housing. It's a question of how you pay for it, whether you provide people with the current system of deeply discounted rents, or whether you move to allow market forces to work and give them a rental voucher equal to the amount difference between what they can afford and what the market rates are. Because if you then eliminated the government ownership of housing and gave everybody a portable voucher, including sitting in their existing unit in former PRH or moving to another place nearer their work or their children's school, then we'd have a much more flexible economy. We'd have the same number of units in the housing stock, which, by the way, is about 2.7 million flats at the moment. There isn't so much of a housing crisis as people think, because there's only about 100 to 150,000 families who are living in subdivided units or inadequately housed, and that can be eaten up with about 6 years' supply of public rental housing at the rate we're going. So it's about roughly a 4% shortfall in supply versus demand right now. It's not massive. And I think that once we've absorbed that demand, unless the government's intent on flooding Hong Kong with much higher immigration than the current 50,000 per year that's coming in under the one-way permit scheme, if it's going to go faster than that, then yes, we need to build huge amounts of supply. But otherwise, we don't. And if they would just stop this artificial argument about 70-30, 60-40, public-private, and just say, here, we're going to recognise this is welfare, we're going to give you all a voucher, and we're going to auction off land for housing, and the landlords can receive the voucher from people who can't afford the whole rent. As simple as that. You have a much more flexible system then. But this was actually a policy address, not just a housing address. And I wonder if we could spend a few remaining minutes talking about some of the other issues.
Can I just put you on pause a little bit, if you don't mind, David, touch on some other topics that are raised by other listeners, because we are going through until 9:30 this morning. And of course,
sorry,
you can.
I've got to leave you.
Thank you very much, indeed, Alan Zeman.
Thank you, Alan Zeman.
To us on the line there from the Lan Kwai Fong Group. And of course, a reminder that tomorrow we can do this with Carrie Lam. If you want to talk directly to her, then just give us a call between 8 and 9 tomorrow. She'll be with us in the studio to talk about the policy address on the usual number, 233-88266. Okay, Michael in an email says, you discussed public housing last week, and my takeaway was that people living in subdivided flats should be rehoused, but that most of the demand is from people trying to gain the system. Demand is not made up of needy poor people, but families attempting to gain new flats for younger members. Mary says, call a spade a spade. The whole point of the East Lantau proposal is to create a public housing ghetto. With the high public housing ratio, the district would not have a great attraction for private buyers, particularly those looking for exclusive luxury locations. Once the island is up and running, then excuses would be found to decant the residents of public housing sites on Kowloon and Hong Kong Island and free up desirable urban sites for developers. Once again, our gullible government has been conned by the tycoons. Just look at the composition of our Hong Kong Foundation. Reserves will be drained on the massive reclamation and infrastructure, while the property developers reap billions on sales of urban units. While others have already gone into the global warming issues that are, of course, of no consequence to the proponents of this mega move, the masses plan. And Joe Average says, Hong Kong has a lot of people living in go-downs, but the government wants to close them down. They have better space and quality of life, and even swimming pools on the roof of some of them now. You want to put back into go-downs again and close down the small businesses. Carrie thinks everyone wants to become a construction worker or a sales assistant. And on Facebook, James says, from the 50s to the 90s, Hong Kong was a music and film entertainment powerhouse. This is an area of Hong Kong's cultural and economic wealth, which is constantly ignored and neglected by the government. At its heart, entertainment production is a grassroots industry, and the talent can come from all walks of life with the right education and support. Music and entertainment also overlaps with the technology, research, and high-tech industries. Maybe science parks, massive subsidies, and empty offices could be used by sound and film production companies. The new Shaw Studios in Cheung Kwan O is also massively underused. It should be a buzzing hive of creativity. That comes from James Banbury. Okay, David Webb, you are unpaused.
Thank you. So, other things in the policy address besides land. Carrie has decided that nobody in Hong Kong should be allowed to import, sell, or distribute e-cigarettes. Now, I think that's a rather draconian move. If we're going to ban e-cigarettes, why aren't we banning cigarettes? Because they're probably 20 times more harmful to health. Both of them contain nicotine, which is addictive, and I don't think that should be sold to people under the age of 18 because you're not capable at that age of distinguishing. If they're going to ban e-cigarettes, then some people who've given up smoking and are still getting their nicotine from vaping are going to go back to smoking, and that's probably negative for the community, for healthcare costs and livelihoods. And so I think she went the wrong way on that. There isn't any sort of evidence-based approach that she's adopting. It seems to be more of a knee-jerk approach, and there isn't any evidence that this is going to... that some people allege that it's a pathway to smoking rather than stopping people heading towards smoking or getting them off cigarettes and back in and onto something much less harmful. There's always some harm in things in life. It's dangerous to drive a car. It's dangerous to walk down the street, but we do it because the benefits outweigh that. She's also talking about maternity leave, that the government is going to pay for 4 weeks up to a salary of $50,000 a month for four extra weeks of maternity leave. I think that's good, but the question is why isn't the government paying for all of it in order to reduce discrimination against women in the job market, particularly amongst SMEs, where losing an employee for 14 weeks and having to find temporary staff and so on is very disruptive. That tends to lead to discrimination against the candidates of childbearing age for jobs. It would be better if we recognise this as a social cost and pay for all of it through the government. So it's a sort of halfway step. She's also talked about reindustrialization and wants to throw taxpayers' money at so-called smart manufacturing and allocate land for it and more land for science parks. And there's an overwhelming amount of interventionist talk on innovation technology generally here. And by the way, there is something for the movie industry, to your caller's point. There is more handouts and subsidies for making movies that people aren't willing to pay to see commercially. because, you know, if they could make a profit making the movie on their own, they would do it. You know, the problem there is if you start taking chunks of land and allocating them to pet projects or pet industries, then you're not being optimal about your use of land. If you simply auction it to the highest bidder for a fixed plot ratio and say, what do you want to do? Do you want to build a movie studio? Do you want to build a data center? Do you want to build a hotel? And leave that flexible. Then, first of all, it can be repurposed later, 20 years down the road, without going to negotiate with the government. And secondly, you get a more optimal result at the start. There's unfortunately too much of that. There's a little bit of bootlicking with Xi Jinping in there as well about his leadership and vision for the Greater Bay Area and so on. This is basically just a warmed-over version of what Tung Chee Hwa called the Greater Pearl River Delta. We've changed the name, but the reality is that we're still three different legal jurisdictions, that you can't import and export freely across the boundaries between parts of the GBA because they're separate customs territories with separate currencies and capital controls for the movement in and out of money. So, yes, we can and do trade extensively with Guangdong. Of course, the manufacturing industry, which is gradually moving out of Guangdong because of costs, they're moving to Vietnam and other places, but for a long time that was a big part of the cooperation between Hong Kong and Guangdong. And that will continue, but there's, you know, dressing it up as the Greater Bay Area is just a political hubris, and so is Belt and Road. There's an awful lot of Belt and Road in the policy address as well. And talk about green bonds. The government's going to issue so-called green bonds. But they're just bonds. It's just borrowing, and it doesn't need to borrow because it's got humongous reserves already. So painting some of them green doesn't do anything except pretend that we're caring more about the environment.
I see that there's only 4 minutes left.
Yes.
So
yeah,
if
please,
I could just... Please. Could just say something aside from, you know, I mean, BPF is very much, has been working on a lot, not just on housing, but we are also working on, and we think what is important is elderly, dealing with the elderly. We very much believe in having it possible for people to die at home, to live as long as possible at home. We think that a lot more needs to be done in that way. Just maybe even equipping public rental housing with, you know, handlebars for old people in the toilets or a simple...
Them out to the Greater Bay Area.
No. I mean, those who want to go and retire there, there are many, by all means, though they are facilitating that in their allowances. But those who want to stay in Hong Kong in their own homes and not have to be pushed to a hospital to die. So we, you know, if we just think of the UK and all the food services, all the support services to try and keep people in their homes. That's what we have to try and aim for. Aside from that, we also believe that the primary health care should be taken care of. We also think more should be done between the wealth gap between the poor and the rich. And as far as innovation and technology is concerned, it will be another discussion with David, because I'm a great believer that Hong Kong has the ability to be somewhere in the technology.
Because if you wanted to look after old people, you could say, well, you could spend that $500 billion on a universal pension.
Yeah, there are different ways, but you're also giving a universal pension to people that don't need the money. So Li Ka-shing will be getting it, and so will a lot of people that don't need it. So you're talking about wasting funds.
That is so wasteful, but you're also bringing us on to the MPF offset proposals, which have now gone up from $7 billion to $39 billion of taxpayer dollars.
There's no problem that can't be solved
with,
you know,
with money, yeah. They ought to have recognised that the MPF superseded the long service payment, that you shouldn't expect to get paid twice when you retire at 65, first with the LSP payout and with the MPF employers' contributions. And that was what was promised to employers, that there would be that continuing offset when the MPF was introduced, because it already existed in the old occupational retirement schemes. And instead they're now trying, because of political pressure, to do both. And ultimately that's going to come at quite some cost to the taxpayers, because the government will, in order to persuade employers not to fight it, they're going to have to pay even probably more than $39 billion. But it's still going to have some perverse effects, the way they've got a really complicated so-called two-tier structure, which will incentivize employers to terminate their contracts and rehire their employees in order to reset the clock and get the 50% subsidy from the government rather than a smaller percentage later if they keep employing them continuously.
Okay.
So it's a mess.
Let's Stephen Wong, final word to you.
Well, it's just 1 minute, but I thought the other...
Go on, have two.
I thought the housing policies I actually liked in terms of, you know, letting the elderly owners above 60 to actually... sell their original flats and buy a smaller subsidized sale flat in the secondary market without paying the premium, as well as letting those who the owners of subsidized sale flat be able to sublet their flats to needy families. Generally, I thought that, you know, the public housing scheme is quite inefficient. In a sense that, given the current housing crisis, in the past 10 years, we have built about 130,000 private units, and that sort of lived additional 500,000 people. But for public housing, we have built 150,000, i.e. more than private units, but the number of people living in there are actually decreasing.
And allowing subletting is just a scam. I mean, you're going to have people queuing up to qualify for their discounted home ownership unit and then letting it out at market rate straight away, or whenever the time period passes that they're allowed to do that. That's not a good idea. But there is one good thing in there about trying to encourage empty nesters to downsize by saying that if you're over 60, I think, are willing to downsize to a smaller PRH unit, then we'll waive the rent for the rest of your life. But that rent would be a lot higher if you used the voucher system in the first place and scale back the vouchers as people leave home.
Okay, I'm afraid we'll have to leave it there. Thank you very much to all of our guests this morning. That was David Webb, you just heard from, shareholder, activist, and founder of website.com. Also Stephen Wong, head of public policy at the R Hong Kong Foundation, and Vicky Davis, vice chairman of the Business and Professionals Federation of Hong Kong. Also Alan Zeman, chairman of the Lan Kwai Fong Group. And before 9 o'clock, Fernando Cheung, Labour Party legislator. And we have a reminder about tomorrow, Hugh.
That's right. Quick advert. Yes. Between 8 and 9, Carrie Lam will be joining us to talk about the policy address. That'll be with Danny Gittings and myself. But it's down to you, basically. Give us a call, 233-88266. We'll put you on the line and you can talk directly to the chief executive. Please phone early because we always get a log jam at the end. And if you want to have a proper chin wag, then dial early, 233-88266. And we'll be putting you on the line from 8 o'clock, between 8 and 9 tomorrow. Look forward to speaking to you then.